This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It really did all change at the start of the 20th century because of the Russian Revolution. And we think about some of the really famous Russian dancers or those associated with dancing, like Anna Pavlova and Diaghilev, who is the great impresario of the Ballet Russe. They left Russia and never went back after the Russian Revolution. So these great Russian ballets then became the repertoire of in Europe and in Britain.
Hello and welcome to the pod. And after a few military-themed episodes, I thought a change would be worthwhile, particularly since we've just had Valentine's Day. And what could be more romantic than ballet? Lucy Ash joins me to talk about its history in the court of Louis XIV, Russian ballet or ballet russe, the point shoes and the difficulties of being a ballerina, as well as major figures in ballet such as Margot Fonteyn and Ninette de Valois. Links are in the show notes. Coming up, I've got the Mau Mau Uprising, the history of football, the mafia, 17th century Japan and plenty more. So please do rate and review and share, share, share. But until then, it's me talking with Lucy Ash on the history of ballet. Okay, Lucy, welcome. It's great pleasure to have you on. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's really lovely to be here.
And so this is a slight change because I decided that our listeners need a bit of culture.
Yeah.
Having recently listened to a military historian discussing generals of World War One and World War Two, it's, I think, time to have a little bit of a break from that and inject some pure culture into our veins. So, Lucy, you are here to do that. So thank you very much. And I should say we're talking, I think, imminently, the day before your book is launched, Sleeping Beauties.
Yes, it is published tomorrow. So it's an exciting time to be talking about it.
Indeed. Indeed. And we're talking about that most romantic of things. And we're talking on Valentine's Day, although this won't actually be going out on Valentine's Day. But what better subject to talk about than the history of ballet? So I, whilst having been to the ballet, so I'm not a complete ignoramus, where did ballet actually begin? Because we've had dance forever. And you yourself, I should mention so the listeners are aware, you come with the sort of highest kind of qualifications or a former ballet dancer and just an expert dancer overall. Is that fair to say?
Maybe not anymore, but yes, ballet used to be my life. I trained at the Royal Ballet School, first as a junior associate and then at the boarding school in Richmond Park. And I didn't go on to become a professional ballet dancer. I ended up going into academics and became an English teacher, but I never left ballet behind. And one of the things that I really remember from my time at the Royal Ballet School was the history of ballet lessons that we had. And I was absolutely fascinated by these, I think probably more than anyone else. And actually, when I was researching for the Sleeping Beauties, but also for my first novel, Clara and Olivia, I had some opportunities to go back to the Royal Ballet School archives, which are these fascinating rooms up at in one of the buildings of the school, and just sort of remind myself of all of those lessons. But to go back to your question about where did ballet all begin, Well, really, it began in the courts, like the Italian Renaissance courts, and it was not a professional occupation. You didn't have professional ballet dancers. It was something that would be there as a kind of court entertainment performed by the courtiers together. And it didn't really look like what we call ballet now. But the big change was in France with Louis XIV, who we know as the Sun King, and I'll talk a little bit about why, I suppose, in a moment, but he loved ballet. So he became king of France when he was, I think, five, and had this 72-year reign. But he just absolutely loved ballet, and he had a ballet master who he had training with every day. And Louis XIV decided that he wanted ballet to be bigger than it had ever been before. He wanted it to be not just court dancers, but he wanted it to be have performances in their own right that were ballet performances. And as Versailles was growing, he built what we know as Versailles now. It was already there before, but I think his grandfather built it as quite a small palace, but it was Louis XIV that made it grow. He had all these fetes and little theatres he put out around the garden. So as the gardens were getting laid out, he was putting on more and more performances. So he had these ballet masters, and he loved to practice ballet, and he decided that you needed professional dancers, not just amateur dancers. So he set up the first
Sorry to
ballet.
interrupt you, Lucy. So does
Yeah.
that mean then really it was kind of people were just not spontaneously, but they'd seen this sort of practice in the Italian courts and they just were almost mimicking it? Because is it a kind of it's a blend between acting and dancing in a way, is it?
Well, there is, in some way, you could say that the mime aspects of ballet have got a kind of acting part to them. And some of the early ballets were very mime heavy. But actually, mime isn't used so much in dance now, because really, if you watch some of those early mime sequences, it's quite hard to identify what they're actually trying to sort of say. So ballet these days kind of removes that element, and it's more focused on through the dance itself, how you can portray the emotions of the dancers and the story you're trying to tell. But yeah, there was elements of mime, but also just what you would imagine as a courtly dance. And it didn't really look a lot like ballet today. They would be wearing high heels, what we know as the turnout that is so the turnout of the legs and the hips that we know is so distinctive from ballet. The aim these days is you want to get 180 degree turnout. That would definitely not be something that they would be aiming for back then. It would be very, very different. You didn't have point shoes initially. Like, the aim now is to have 180 degree turnout of your hips, but that was definitely not what you would be aiming for in the Versailles courts of Louis XIV. He set up a dance school, a professional company, but still, it wasn't really ballets like we see today. Actually, the more common thing was to have opera ballets or comedy ballets. So the opera ballets were this mix of music, singing with some ballet at the same time, and the comedy ballets were actually plays. Molière, for example, wrote quite a few, and they would be plays, but there would be little ballet kind of interludes in amongst it.
Oh, wonderful. So this grew up in Louis XIV's court. Did it spread fast or did it take a bit of time? Because I mean, Louis XIV was hugely influential for many European monarchs.
It definitely spread through Europe. Ballet is so interesting because it had this ebb and flow of status. So sometimes it is a court performance, sometimes it's a little divertissement as part of a show or a ballet in its own right. But I suppose the next important moment that we could go to would be the Italian Romantic era ballets. And I suppose the most famous dancer would be Marie Taglioni. She sort of, I suppose, represents now what we see, what we imagine as the ballet dancer. So this kind of ethereal woman who's dancing on her toes, wearing like a white chiffon dress of some type. She kind of brought that in. So it really was a change from the more courtly style of dancing to this kind of ethereal style. And Marie Taglioni is, so she was born in the early 1800s, and her father was in the theatre, and he ended up choreographing a lot of her ballets. So, for example, La Sylphide is probably the most famous one. And she's Swedish, but she moved to Vienna and she lived in Paris for a bit. So it was really, it grew up in that kind of style of dance, grew up in Italy. But she's often credited, I think wrongly, to be the first dancer to wear pointe shoes. There were actually other dancers that wore pointe shoes, but they weren't particularly elegant, I think, in the way that they wore them.
Is
There's
that
a
a
there's actually
diplomatic way of,
yeah.
right?
There's a great TV documentary, I think, that's available still at the moment, that's just been put on the BBC, called The Magic of Dance by Margot Fonteyn. Well, it's sort of led by Margot Fonteyn, and they've just put it back up again. And she talks about this, and she talks about how Marie Taglioni was the first dancer to sort of look good doing point work. So the other dancers before had to really kind of use their arms and like heave themselves up, and it didn't really look very elegant at all. Whereas Taglioni was much more elegant and light in the way that she danced. And that's when you have the development of the pointe shoe. I don't know if you know much about pointe shoes, but
Well, they
they're
look, you're going to have to tolerate some extremely irritatingly stupid questions, but or comments that, but they look incredibly painful.
So, are they painful? They can be very painful if you have not prepared your feet properly, or if you've been dancing for many, many hours in that day and they're just becoming bruised and sore. In terms of these days, how we prepare for wearing pointe shoes, you would do many years of strengthening exercises before you put on your first pair of pointe shoes. So metatarsal exercises that sort of strengthen that area, and also just the ballet class itself with all the pliés, tendus, are just gradually building up the strength in the feet.
It
Most
looks
people,
like a huge amount of strain on the calf muscles as well. Is that?
yes. Ideally, you're sort of pulling up through out of your hips. You're using all of your muscles in your legs, but it does definitely require a lot of strength. But also, it's just that the toes themselves and the skin builds up strength. So one of the things that we used to do at the Royal Ballet School is we would have sort of two buckets, one with cold water, one with surgical spirit, and you would just move between, or you would also rub surgical spirit on your toes every evening, just to try and strengthen the skin, because really you want to be able to wear them for as many hours as you need without it becoming painful. But if you look back to some of the early pointe shoes, so this kind of romantic era time, so around the kind of mid 1800s, the pointe shoe is so soft. There's very little protective or stabilizing material, and it's kind of amazing to imagine how these dancers were able to support themselves on this shoe, whereas the shoes now have got a lot more stability. They're almost too hard. You can't actually dance immediately in a pointe shoe when you get your new pair of pointe shoes. You have to break it in. So some dancers hit them on concrete steps. Some of them hit them with a hammer because you want to try and get the noise out of them, so you're not clumping around on the stage. Sort of, you want to make them as soft as you can, but while also providing support.
What are they made of? The padding or the material? What is.
So it's leather, satin, and a sort of paste that goes into it. But the paste and the canvas as well breaks down quite quickly. So pointe shoes these days will probably last you, as a professional dancer, maybe you'd get through sort of three or four pairs a week of
A
these shoes.
week.
Yes,
And I bet they're not cheap.
No, they're not. When I was at school dancing every day, by my final year, I was getting through about three pairs a week. And you can't just, as I said, put them on and wear them. You have to sew the ribbons on, sew the elastics on, you have to darn the ends, break them in. So your life becomes this cycle of preparing pointe shoes, and then they become what we call dead. Your pointe shoe is dead, and you have to throw them out and prepare a new pair. So it's pointe shoes is just, I think, because of this cycle of repetition, of they're so fragile as well. They almost, for me, feel like a symbol of the ballet dancer's life, really, the pointe shoe.
Yeah, that's a nice way of looking at it. And so were these pairs that were a lot softer in the past then, would that mean that there wouldn't have been dancing for as long as professional dancers now?
It's hard to say for sure because I think they would have been training quite intensely every day, but the types of performances they would be doing might be slightly different. So we don't actually have obviously any filmed records of this. So all we can really look at is illustrations, paintings of these early dancers and kind of look at the way they were standing and the way that the position is. And it seems like the dancing was not quite as athletic as how you might describe it now. So I think perhaps the shoes didn't need to be quite as strong. As dancers' legs have got higher, so these days, you know, dancers are very, very flexible. There's a huge amount of athleticism that goes into it. That has been a real development in ballet. Back in the 1800s, you would not be expecting a dancer's leg to be up by their ear. That was not what ballet was. So as some of that change has come in, the point shoes had to adapt as well.
And so then I was interested in the music that would be best associated with it, because we'll get on to the Russians. And of course, I think certainly when I think of ballet, I think of Tchaikovsky. But what were the sort of composers that would be working best with that early form of ballet?
By the time you get to Tchaikovsky working in Russia with the ballet master Petipa, to actually be able to have a composer like Tchaikovsky working on a ballet was quite a radical thing, because ballet music was seen as needing to be quite simple. It was seen that if the music was too complex, dancers wouldn't be able to cope with it, and actually you need a fairly sort of simple style. And then Petipa brought in Tchaikovsky, Tchaikovsky's acquaintances, you know, musical friends, were actually very surprised that he was working on a ballet. He sort of felt that he was wasting his time by working on, you know, like Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty. Whereas of course now that is music that is, I suppose, we see that music as so powerful in its own right. It's not just because it's attached to a ballet. So I think that late 1800 shift to the creation of these famous Petipa Russian ballets did also change the way that we saw the relationship between music and ballet.
And is that because it's quite a conservative world?
Yeah, I think so. And it's just a change, isn't it, to the way they might see their status. And going back to what I said before about the status of ballet constantly changing, you know, sometimes actually not being seen as one of the important art forms, and at other times being seen as like really central to the movement of a particular, you know, development in art at that time. So I think with the late 1800s and with Tchaikovsky starting to write for ballet music, that was a very important step.
I'm going to make sure my wife listens to this episode, because I took her to the Bolshoi at performing Swan Lake, and it was extraordinary. But that makes me think now, that was the involvement of Tchaikovsky. Does that then make a Russian ballet first and foremost in the world of ballet? Because even now they have this incredible reputation.
They really do. And it's very interesting, because it wasn't until the French ballet masters went to Russia that Russia took on this great reputation. And Petipa, who's the choreographer of the Sleeping Beauty and many other of the great classical ballets that we know, he is French. And he's a French ballet master who went there and worked with the Imperial Ballet Theatre. And there was a lot of support from the Tsar for ballet, and there was a lot of money that went into it, and that you could be paid quite a lot as a choreographer, as a dancer in Russia at that time. So I think it's because of those different circumstances that it led to Russia creating these wonderful ballets, these wonderful story ballets. But then it really did all change at the start of the 20th century because of the Russian Revolution. And we think about some of the really famous Russian dancers, or those associated with dancing, like Anna Pavlova and Diaghilev, who's the great impresario of the Ballet Russe. They left Russia and never went back after the Russian Revolution. So these great Russian ballets then became the repertoire of in Europe and in Britain. So it's a really an interesting relationship, I think, to Russia, certainly.
Yes, because certainly during, and you can pick me up on when this was, but the Soviets took ballet very seriously themselves, didn't they?
Yes, they did. But those who had defected, or you know, who had left, Serge Diaghilev, the impresario of the Ballet Russe, was sort of written out of Soviet history because he had left in 1909, I think. He went to Europe and then he didn't go back. And I mean, throughout the 20th century, you have dancers leaving in often very dramatic ways while on tour and becoming attached to a different company. Think about Rudolf Nureyev, for example. You know, his sort of escaping from, he defected, he and then he didn't go back. So yeah, it's a complicated relationship, I think.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yes, and so let's talk about some of those personalities. I mean, you know, Rudolf Nureyev is very famous. Margot Fonteyn is probably... the most famous.
Yeah. I mean, Margot Fonteyn is, she is British ballet. You know, that's what she is. And so her name was Peggy Margaret Hookham, and she changed it to Margot Fonteyn. As in those early years, like the 1930s, early years of British ballet, lots of the dancers did change their names to sound more European, Italian, Russian, because it wasn't, ballet just wasn't seen as a British form of art until really the 1930s. And even then it was a little bit slow, because the early part of the 20th century was dominated by the Ballet Russe. So the Ballet Russe was a company that was led by Diaghilev, who was not a dancer himself, but he had this incredible talent for bringing together people who could work wonderfully well together. And he could do incredible staging. He brought composers, designers, dancers, and worked with the choreographer Mikhail Fokine, for example, who is, we think of when we think of the Ballet Russe and some of those early ballets of the 20th century, like Petrushka and the Firebird. And that was so exciting. That was actually, everyone was sort of excited about the Ballet Russe and sort of not really thinking about the Petipa Russian ballets anymore. They wanted something new, something modern, something. It really, I think Diaghilev was bringing ballet onto the same level as like modernist art and literature and music. And you know, he worked with Stravinsky. And that's what the British public thought of as ballet, was the Russian, was the Ballet Russe. So Diaghilev died in 1929 and his company fell apart, and lots of dancers did actually create sort of mini versions of the Ballet Russe, and you had a few different companies that represented that. But this really gave an opportunity for British ballet to find its own beat. And I suppose the most famous person we talk about is, as well as Margot Fonteyn, is Dame Ninette de Valois.
Yes.
So Dame Ninette de Valois is like, you know, the founder of British ballet. So she danced for the Ballet Russe and she was part of that world. She knew it very well. And she set up a school in 1926 called the Academy of Choreographic Art. And
she was Irish, wasn't she, originally?
Irish, yes. Mm.
And changed her name like Margot Fonteyn.
Yes, yeah, she did.
Because Margot Fonteyn's original surname is Hookham.
Yeah, Margot Fonteyn is Hookham.
Isn't the sort of name you want as a ballerina, is it? You can see why she changed it.
Yes, but actually later on, dancers did stop changing their names because they wanted to feel more British in their, you know, to give this status.
And Ninette was Edris Stannis.
Oh, Edris Stannis, yes.
So lots of sort of violent consonants doesn't help when you're trying to come up with a name.
No, and she was dancing with the Ballet Russe, so she did need to fit in, and Edra Stannis as a name perhaps didn't fit in the same way. But she was a very talented woman, a little bit like Diaghilev in the sense that she was able to bring together people that could make things happen. And she developed a partnership with Lillian Bayliss, who was the manager at the Old Vic Theatre. And they decided to get lots of people together to help raise some money to renovate Sadler's Wells Theatre, because Sadler's Wells Theatre at this point was in ruins. There's some fascinating archival photographs of children sitting in the ruins of Sadler's Wells Theatre. There's been a lot of theatres on that site in Sadler's Wells over the years, but at that point in the late 1920s, there wasn't one. But they managed to get the money together and they opened Sadler's Wells Theatre. And in 1931, Dame Ninette de Valois started her ballet company called the Vic Wells Ballet Company. And the reason for the name is because they performed at both the Old Vic Theatre and the Sadler's Wells Theatre. And there are some really interesting accounts of dancers and audiences getting very confused as to which theatre they were supposed to be going to each night. They moved between them quite a lot. And at that time, they really had to, the Vic Wells Ballet Company had to work quite hard to prove themselves that they were a ballet company worth their salt. They could be as good as the Ballet Russe. And Dame Ninette de Valois did this in a variety of ways. She choreographed a lot herself. She managed to find Frederick Ashton, the famous British choreographer, and he started choreographing a lot for the company. But she also decided to bring to Britain the great Russian ballets. She thought, actually, let's make these wonderfully successful ballets like The Sleeping Beauty, Capalia, Swan Lake, The Nutcracker. Let's make these the backbone of the British repertoire. So she traveled to Paris and she found the stage manager from the Imperial Ballet who had left Russia in the wake of the October Revolution. He's called Nicholas Sergeyev. And when he'd left Russia, he had taken with him this trunk containing all the notation books of those famous Petipa ballets, Petipa, but also this choreographer called Lev Ivanov. And he then helped her to stage these ballets. And so Capalia was one of the first, only the first two acts. And that's the ballet that I write about a lot in my first novel, Clara and Olivia. That's Clara and Olivia set in 1933. And it's all in the build-up to putting on this production of Capalia, and which Sergeyev was helping them put on. So she made some really clever decisions to help give British ballet its own feel at that time. And she also brought in some fantastic dancers. So she found Margot Fonteyn when Margot Fonteyn was 14. And Fonteyn talks about her audition for the company where she arrived, but she hadn't brought any of her ballet clothes. So she was told to take off her tights and skirt and just perform, like practice in her bare feet. And she was chosen and very quickly rose to kind of star status. And did incredibly well and performed for many, many years. And in my book, The Sleeping Beauties, she features quite a lot because the book culminates with the performance of The Sleeping Beauty that opened the Royal Opera House after the war in 1946. And she performed as Princess Aurora in that performance.
Amazing, amazing. I was doing a bit of reading into Ninette de Valois, and you'll be able to clear this up, actually, having been through this probably hugely strenuous process of becoming a ballet dancer. Is that I got the impression that de Valois was quite a stern mistress. And I'm sure some listeners may have seen the film Black Swan with. Is it a stereotype that the kind of teacher is this really tough dancer who's been through it all themselves and has been treated badly themselves, so they're just sort of recycling the process? Or is that, it's a bit overdone and actually everyone's lovely and cuddling each other at the end of every day?
That's a really interesting question. Dainonette de Valois was terrifying. Everyone wanted to be performing at their best. If she walked into the ballet class, the ballet studio, the atmosphere would change in that way. But she did have this status as, she created this company. They relied on her completely for the development of ballet, for the development of the company. She was a very impressive woman. And I suppose ballet, it does, yes, I think the teachers do tend to have a reputation, an accurate reputation of being quite tough. It certainly isn't going to be everyone being more friendly with each other at the end of the class. And I think because ballet it's a perfectionistic type of art form, and you do have to be quite ruthless with yourself when you're dancing, and you need, I suppose, that atmosphere. Whether it is necessary or not, I'm not sure. I personally am still terrified by many of my ballet dancers, by my ballet teachers. The thought of some of my ballet teachers from the Royal Ballet School, they do send a bit of a shiver down your spine thinking about what they would say if they saw the way you were standing. Is your posture right? They have, I think ballet teachers have this fascinating relationship with their students, because you want them to notice you, and you want them to think that, obviously you're a good enough dancer, but you also really want them to criticize you. Because if you're not criticized, if the ballet teacher, you go through the entire ballet class without the teacher saying anything to you, then you feel like, what am I doing? They haven't even noticed me. This is terrible. I'm not gonna make it. It's a disaster. Whereas if they give you a correction, then that feels wonderful, and you're like, yes, they've taken the time to think about my dancing, to notice me. So we would come out of ballet class, and we'd sort of like tally up how many corrections we got from the teacher in the lesson. So I don't know that I think yes, what Black Swan, the film, is obviously an exaggerated version, but I do think ballet lends itself well to books about obsession and excessive hard work and dedication and focus, because you do need those things in order to make it in the ballet world.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I wonder how it will respond to nowadays, where I guess people are a little bit more, I don't know what the right word is for fear of insulting a younger generation, but maybe more sensitive.
I think perhaps some of things could do with changing in terms of the way that young girls and boys are growing up doing intense ballet, but also having a very tormented relationship with their own body, perhaps, because you're getting graded on your physique once a term.
Is
And
diet very important? They'll make sure you're eating the right foods and things like that.
it is important, but obviously when you're a teenager and you're training that way, everyone's diet is going to be quite different because of growth spurts and when you hit certain stages of your development. So it's not as simple as saying like everyone has got to be eating the same thing. It's more like you need to look a certain way. And the challenge tends to be that obviously you're developing and you're changing and you're growing, but you also want to maintain that look of the ethereal ballet dancer. And I think that is something that ballet schools are spending more time now reflecting on and thinking about, okay, how can we help these young people to be the best dancer they can without leaving kind of permanent damage in terms of their attitude to their own bodies? Because it's a very formative time when you're at ballet school. There's a book called Don't Think Dear by Alice Robb that is just coming out in paperback now. That's absolutely brilliant about this. And she studied at the School of American Ballet, which is sort of the American equivalent of the Royal Ballet. And she examines George Balanchine, who is the founder of the New York City Ballet, and his that same sort of relationship he had with his dancers, and sort of the fear that they had whenever he came into the room and wanting to look perfect for him the whole time. And she examines ballet in the light of the Me Too movement, feminism, and sort of changing attitudes to women's roles in the world generally, because ballet is something that often treats women a little bit like like children. And it one of the really interesting things that I've seen developing more is a higher number of female choreographers. You know, we've been talking about all these different dancers and directors, and most of them have been men. Dame Ninette de Valois is one of the few women that we have mentioned, but actually she didn't really have many female choreographers working for her. She mostly had male choreographers. So I think changing that balance a little bit, so not having all male choreographers, can be very helpful as well.
It's so fascinating. It really is. If we go back to the 1930s and then into the 40s, because in your book, and you've written a piece for us in our latest magazine, and it's so interesting reading about the ballet company going on a tour at rather a, I think their timing could have been a little bit better.
Well, yes, it's a fascinating moment in the company's history. So by this stage, the company is called the Sadler's Wells Ballet Company. It's May 1940, and they go off on a tour to Holland. And so the Netherlands, Holland is neutral at this stage. You know, they've not yet joined the war. But looking back with hindsight now, it was clearly only a matter of time before Germany invaded. And it did, it was when the ballet company was in The Hague. They had just returned from a day of performing in some towns quite close to the German border. It was very clear the mood was changing, that Germany invaded in the Battle for The Hague, and they were trapped there. They had to be evacuated. There was very slow bus journeys. They had a couple of nights in this house in the woods, sort of hidden away with loads of other refugees, and then traveling again on this very slow bus, apparently 3 miles, took about 3 hours, just sort of creeping along, trying to get to this cargo ship they were going to get on, and then across the North Sea back to England. So remarkably, they all made it out alive. It was fine, but they did lose a lot of costumes and sets and notation books and scores, musical scores. But in my book, one of the moments of the book, one of the key sections of it, takes place during this trip to Holland. And I suppose I have added a bit of extra drama to it that didn't necessarily happen, but I think it's still a really dramatic event to happen. And there's a brilliant diary, very lengthy diary account of it from one of the corps de ballet members, who's written about every sort of stage of the trip, which is just absolutely wonderful gold dust for someone, for a historical writer, fiction writer, who finds something like that and is able to use as many of those details as I could in my novel.
Yeah, I mean, I've got visions of these poor ballerinas in the sort of coach worrying about, you know, that's not what they signed up for, was it?
No, and lots of them were incredibly young. So the Dame Ninette de Valois memoir of and her writing about this, you know, she does talk about feeling this great responsibility that she has taken these very young dancers, some of them aren't even 20 yet, and she is responsible for them, and she's got to get them back to their parents safe and sound. And that, you know, they did not expect this to happen during the trip, though there are some accounts of this trip, this tour, that suggests that the British Council, who sent them, Lord Lloyd, who sent them, did get information that suggested there might be a German invasion around that time, but they could not cancel the trip because it would sort of reveal the carefully planned espionage that had gone into it. Whether that is true or not, I'm not sure, but it's certainly something that quite a few of the dancers talk about when they have written about this moment.
I also wonder, they perhaps saw a different side to de Valois. Perhaps she had a broader maternal instinct during this difficult time.
Maybe.
So where's ballet today? I mean, probably Billie Elliot's been huge, hasn't it? I mean, it's 20 years old now, so maybe you probably have a view on where ballet is sort of 20 years on today. I'm going to use this dreaded word elitist, but do you think that's fair still?
Going back to that idea of ballet constantly changing status, I think ballet went through an elitist state time. It went through a time when actually it was difficult to afford ballet lessons. It was difficult to afford to go to the theatre, and I think it still is. But I think that more is happening now to try and encourage more people to be able to go to the theatre or to be able to go to a ballet school to take ballet lessons. The Royal Opera House, for example, does do quite a lot of young person evenings where they're, it's cheaper tickets and they're trying to change the way that you might look at looking at going to the theatre. Because I remember maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, always feeling really difficult to get a ticket for something at the theatre, at the Royal Opera House, because the tickets would just go immediately and then they're really expensive. But there are now ways of that they're trying to open it up more. I think also with one of the big changes in making ballet feel a little bit more accessible for everyone has been social media. Because in the past, the whole ballerina lifestyle was very hidden. It was sort of this glamorous life with probably some pain underneath, but you didn't really know anything about it. But now, like ballet talk or ballet Instagram is huge. And lots of these very well, famous dancers, but also members of Court of Ballet, people of elite ballet schools, they will be putting up these little videos all the time about, day in the life as a ballet dancer, how I prepare my pointe shoes, or let's take a look backstage, or like my warm-up routine before I go on stage. And I think that has been really great for showing, yes, ballet's very strange world, but also showing everyone that world and making it easier to understand what it is that goes on behind the scenes. So perhaps that's had a bit of a change as well. But I think if you think back to ballet during the Second World War, it was quite accessible in the sense that the Sadler's Wells Ballet Company was touring all over the country. Like no town was too small for them. They were working incredibly hard to take ballet all around the place. And that's when I think this sort of love of ballet started to grow nationally. But it's how you maintain that accessibility even in normal times as well. I suppose that's the challenge really.
Yeah, that's extraordinary that they were doing that, during war. One would imagine that, I mean, it would be difficult to persuade dancers to do that nowadays if there was a war on and you've got a bombing campaign in major cities throughout the United Kingdom. So your book's launched tomorrow. Have you sent copies to your former directors at the ballet?
Yes. So, well, actually, some of my ballet teachers are coming to my book launch party tomorrow, and they came as well to the Clara and Olivia one last year. So that was really nice, and I ended up doing an interview back at the Royal Ballet School last time for Clara and Olivia as well, which was great because I suppose I had been a little bit nervous about kind of coming back into the ballet world this way. I'd been a dancer from my formative years, and then I'd left it. I'd gone to university, I'd become an English teacher, and I didn't really feel like the ballet world was for me anymore. And I think it's always very difficult when you leave something you've been doing that intensely, and you have to either just actually, I can't deal with that anymore, I'm moving on, I'm doing something else, or you come back to it. And I think for me, ballet just never left me. I remained passionate about it, and writing Clara and Olivia and The Sleeping Beauties has been so fulfilling because it's been a way of coming back to ballet in a way that works for me. It's through literature, which is my other great love. So it's been a very rewarding time, actually.
Great stuff. Well, so for listeners, links are all in the show notes. This has been absolutely fascinating. I guess it's a world that many people are unaware of, but when you kind of pull back the cover and, even learning about the pointe shoes, I guess even if you're in a smaller role in a ballet production, the work even to get there is
Oh,
extraordinary.
absolutely. I mean, for the number of places in a company compared to the number of people training to dance, I mean, not very a very small percentage is actually going to make it into a company. So it's a very difficult career to embark upon, that's for sure.
Lucy, this has been fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. It really did all change at the start of the 20th century because of the Russian Revolution. And we think about some of the really famous Russian dancers or those associated with dancing, like, well, Anna Pavlova and Diaghilev, who is the great impresario of the Ballet Russe. They left Russia and never went back after the Russian Revolution. So these great Russian ballets then became the repertoire of in Europe and in Britain.
Thank you for listening. Coming up, I've got plenty of great history in this month's film club, which is Bonnie and Clyde and Public Enemies as a double bill, both movies on 1930s gangsters, which will be a nice warm-up for my chat about the mafia with Louis Ferrante. But until then, thank you and good night.